Steven, your host for this hour of Pretentious Thoughts About Gaming. As always, with me is JT, our illustrious co-host and founder of what I hope is an entertaining experience for all three of you. Today we're, as you may know, if you've been listening to the show, we're continuing kind of our exploration about video games as art. It's a subject that's touched upon here and there and everywhere, but we wanted to add our thoughts into the mix and kind of do a unified series looking at each individual component of how video games are thought of as art. And someone pointed out something to me. Part of what causes this is if you look at games from a copyright perspective or from sort of a more legal perspective, then games don't have a copyright. They have about a dozen copyrights, much like music or films. And each component can be looked at sort of as a separate work of art that is then combined to make yet another work of art. And so that's sort of why the episodic approach to looking at the different individual themes, and then we'll go back and maybe look at some of the broader themes. But for today, we will continue with last week's exploration of story by moving into graphics, or what you might call the art, the graphic art of gaming.
And I just want to make a quick correction that Steven has two parents and I have two parents, so we have at least four listeners out there. And
so true.
One of the things that always intrigues me about graphics is art styling, and whether or not that's a decision that's made early in a game's life or something that evolves into a game's life. And for a long time, graphics were solely dependent on technological limitations. So you look at the original Mario Brothers or any original Nintendo game, you were limited in the amount of colors you had. And I think one of the most famous examples is in DuckTales, they changed Scrooge McDuck's blue coat into a red coat because of a graphics limitation. And another big thing that has sort of come up in the remakes of the original Mega Mans is the sprite flicker of Mega Man, and then the amount of enemies that you could have at the screen. So a lot of times, technology and graphics sort of go hand in hand, and I think an interesting place to start is maybe just original sprite-based graphics.
Sure. Sprite-based graphics were sort of were simple. So we talked last week about how we grew out of text-based games, which would, of course, I guess, be no graphics, really, or graphics only insofar as sometimes you can make ASCII maps or use symbols to represent different areas or pictures. And so that is actually, I guess, even before sprite-based graphics, is just flat out, we can make things that look vaguely like a shape by putting the right symbols on the screen. But then moving directly to sprite-based graphics, the idea was you could create a small number of art assets. It's, in many ways, it reminds me of how South Park, the television show, is made. You make a small number of basically cutouts or sprites, and then you can use those in different situations, and they don't really move so much as they transition between poses. And even as recently as I'm thinking here of Final Fantasy VI, anytime they would have a joyous expression, they were tiny, so they had to have very large, it's the same issue you have in stage acting, they had to have very large expressions. They were never smirking, they were mouths wide open with laugh lines coming out of their eyes. They had to be big, and that's how sprites worked. They had to be snapshot representations of different things that you'd want to see. But even with those individual just snapshots, you could get a lot of emotion. You could tell the story. You could move the story forward. And so, in many ways, and the order we chose to cover these topics in is sort of driven by this, the graphics existed to drive the story, which required greater graphics so that you could tell more detailed stories.
And I think one of the interesting places to start that Steven brings up a good point is the Zork games on the PC with their text-based and the other Infocom games that started with these maps and started with these images got people thinking, well, we could actually start making graphics. And then you look at sort of that evolving into something like King's Quest, where you had very simple graphics. You had 16 rooms. The characters could roll through the top. The northern room led to the bottom of the southern room. They went, east to west, were all lined up. And then you started to have puzzles in there. And one of the interesting things to me has always been, when you look at it, how much these simple characters still resonate with people. You can say King Graham, and people have a mental image of King Graham, but a lot of it's because it's in their imagination. So some of these sprite graphics impart something into the imagination. When you look at Super Mario Brothers, the original one that came with Duck Hunt. I mean, it's a very blocky, pixelated character with not a lot of detail, but people instinctively know what Mario looks like. They have a relationship to him, and I think there's something about the beauty in the simplicity of some of those graphics that really resonates with people.
I think so, and so that's where a lot of times you'll hear something that I'm going to preface by saying I absolutely don't believe is true. You'll hear people say, well, graphics don't matter. It's not really about the graphics because the game is sort of an independent unit, and you'll hear people kind of indicate, you know, the game is good, it shouldn't matter what the graphics are. Okay, the game is indistinguishable from the graphics because it is... It shouldn't be the only consideration, but it depends on the kind of game you're trying, the kind of story or the kind of experience, maybe is a better way to say it, that you're trying to portray. Those, you know, Mario, everyone knows what Mario looks like. It was what was needed to work with that experience, the experience of a platformer, of going around, beating up on enemies, collecting coins. That experience worked with that graphic styling. It would be difficult to tell a detailed story about... we'll use Final Fantasy VI again. Even though it used sprites, they were detailed enough that you could get expression, and that was important. To get that experience across, you needed to have enough graphics to be able to show text well, a lot of text well, and to communicate quickly, which, if anyone who remembers the Mario text and kind of pixelated text, sometimes it was not super readable because it was blocky and square-like, for lack of a better term. And so the graphics are part of the game. You can't distinguish between the two that way. And the question I think should be, does the graphic quality allow for the overall experience that the game designer was trying to get across?
And that is a solid point. And to me, graphics is always the emotional hook. As people, humans, we rely heavily on sight and our senses to relate to a game. And when you look at video games, you really run out of the senses you can use to do it. You have the tactile response with the controller. You have the visual cues you see with your eyes. There's not really a smell. There's not really a taste. You have hearing, which I still remember the parrot from the original Sound Blaster, for those of you who remember what a revolution that was. So you really kind of look at the ways in which something can hook you. And sight is often the gateway to the emotional hook. So when Steven brings up a point and says that a lot of people say graphics don't matter, I think they refer to the quality aspect. So a game with simple graphics can be enjoyable as a game with complex graphics. But I sometimes wonder if the better question that's asking is whether or not graphics matter in the sense of being able to provide an emotional hook. Can 3D polygons provide a better emotional hook than hand-drawn sprites or, you know, computer-generated sprites or a watercolor-based game?
Absolutely. And I think it all goes back to the emotional hook. Can you accomplish the goal of the game? And so kind of the question that comes up is, you know, what... Sometimes things are woefully out of balance. There are beautiful games that are just really not very good experiences. There are games with fairly low graphic quality that are actually quite good. Kickstarter is causing a resurgence in what, you know, many would consider to be low graphics games, isometric games like the original Fallout and Fallout 2. We're seeing more of that because it turns out, I think some people are surprised by this, I was certainly surprised by the magnitude, there are a lot of people out there who want those experiences still. And so, you know, that's, I think, on the graphics don't matter side of things. There are people, there are games out there, there are stories, there are experiences that people want that don't require a lot of graphics. That is not to say, I remember a recent one is Skyrim, where there was a part of me that just wandered around for a little bit, kind of looking at the skyline and touching the different plants, because it was just really pretty. And that was the experience they wanted. They wanted they sat down with the goal of, we want people to experience a world. And part of experiencing a world, as JT indicated, is we use sight. And so to really make a game that's about photorealism, as it would be referred to, you need a certain amount of photorealism, even when you're dealing with things like dragons that are not real. Sorry for anyone who is upset by that statement.
And I just want to make a quick disclaimer that Steven's a liar.
Yes. We have a dragon, actually, but we are keeping him from you. No, but that's true. It's always interesting to me when movies, television, and video games do photorealism for things that aren't real, which ultimately most of it, even if you look at a show like NCIS, you know, it's the people aren't real. So on some level, most fiction is about creating photorealism for things that didn't actually happen. Art and games does a lot of that. And so you can create photorealism, or you cannot do that and use other means to get your story across. Final Fantasy VII would be my example of a game that really, if you go back, the fact that no one has hands is a little off-putting. But they have kind of stubs during most of the wandering around phase. But and yet, it told what is considered to be a very gripping story. And so higher level graphics, obviously, there weren't needed to get that experience across.
And I want to kind of break this down into some smaller components. One of the things I think helps in sprite-based games is they're able to crib off of animators. They're able to crib off of Disney and Warner Brothers and Hanna-Barbera and name whatever animation house you want earlier, who knows how to convey human emotions in a hand-drawn figure. And I think a lot of that people resonate back to sprites or hand-drawn images or isometric games like Fallout is there's a real sense of how these characters should look, and so there's a familiarity to it. When you look at something like Final Fantasy VII, I mean, when that came out, that was completely alien. And it's sort of, as Stephen pointed out, they didn't have hands, but was it off-putting in the sense that you realize it's off-putting, or is it now off-putting that you've now seen 3D models without hands?
Oh, yes, absolutely. If I was unclear about that, it's difficult to go back. At the time, it was amazing. It was actually the third Final Fantasy game I had played through at that point. And it was an incredible experience. I actually got it on the PC when Eidos, or Eidos, I've never been sure how to pronounce that, finally released it. Square brought it over to the PC, and I didn't have any console gaming systems, but I was already a member of the glorious PC Master Race. And so I got to play it there, and at the time, no, it blew me away, especially the cutscenes. The first time I saw the FMV sequences in Final Fantasy VII, it was a true leap forward, and that's sort of my example of how the art of games evolves. We expect more out of stories now. We also kind of expect more out of the art now, not because we demand shinier things, but because technology has advanced. Even when we look at, I believe Shadowrun is one of the isometric games that's coming out, its graphics are better than Fallout. Even though it's an isometric game, we just expect higher textures because the machinery can handle it. It's easy enough to code. It's just how the march of progress moves on.
Well, let me ask you this. Do you think that we expect higher graphics because we expect it to look prettier, or we think we'll build a better emotional connection to a higher fidelity image?
A little column A, little column B. What I'll say is I think it's about that emotional connection. And part of that, though, is that you do, to a certain extent, I think, get... the word I'm going to use is desensitized. We now are used to forming pretty deep emotional connections and knowing characters, even in games where the characters are kind of a secondary throwaway to shooting stuff. And even then, you know, I know more than anyone has a right to about the characters from Dead Space, which, who cares? You're there to shoot zombies. But still, though, we develop sort of a, you know, the survival experience kind of forges a relationship with that character. And so that is a story that would have been hard to tell without the graphics level that's required, and the sound, actually, and we'll talk about sound some other time, but Dead Space relies heavily on the visual and the sound, especially sound. And any game that relies on the unseen is going to rely a lot on sound. And so you're really talking about, now, once you've experienced that, is it more difficult to go back and get the same emotional connection? It's not impossible, but I think it is harder. I think you kind of grow to expect more out of the experience over time.
And when looking at 3D polygon figures, and I think Dead Space is an interesting choice, how concerned are you about the Valley of the Uncanny?
I think that's an interesting theory with a lot of practical application. I think video game characters generally don't look like people, and so it avoids the problem. What do I mean by that? Isaac is in a spacesuit He does not. Now, some of the other characters look human. They do quite well, but they're much smaller than humans because they are on a screen. They typically are viewed kind of from a distance. And so, let's start with this. Why don't you explain a little bit about the Uncanny Valley?
The Uncanny Valley is that there's a point where you start with an animated human or a hand-drawn human, and you see it as a cartoon character, so you can feel a relationship to it. But as that character evolves, becomes more realistic, and looks more human, it actually becomes more off-putting because we see it in a way that makes the character look dead or lifeless or dead behind the eyes. And that triggers sort of a lizard brain response of, that looks dangerous, that makes me nervous, I need to avoid it. And I always thought one of the examples of it for me personally was in Half-Life 2. And that's kind of the first time you would see heavily, for me, facial animations in the character. And there were some moments where I was interacting with Alex where she would look realistic, but her facial movements wouldn't quite register with the words. And I found it off-putting and sort of made me nervous, not necessarily in the context of the story or the way they intended, but it sort of interfered with my ability to kind of bond with the character. Another example is very early in the game, and I think this one was more on purpose, where you talk to, and I apologize because I forget the character's name, but the mystery man, yeah, the cigarette-smoking man, archetype character, where they try to make him look inhuman. And I always wondered is whether or not they realized they could do these facial animations, and that was sort of a side effect of that. So then they incorporated it back into the character to resonate with it.
Sure. I think Half-Life 2 is interesting because I did get some of the off-puttingness, but what I think the Uncanny Valley is an interesting theory, but I think it revolved around the idea that we would never be able to get to the point where we could render people close enough that the brain didn't respond that way. I was not put off by the characters in Mass Effect 3. I thought general, and you spend a lot of time watching Commander Shepard talk. And part of that may have been the spacesuits. Like I said, I think in a sense, as long as the game looks like a game, my personal theory, which I have absolutely no backing for, is that as graphics have improved, we've learned to more finely distinguish between reality and video games. Because video games look like reality, but they're still not reality. They're animated, ultimately. And so I think we now draw finer and finer distinctions. And as that distinction becomes finer, I think also the valley becomes narrower. Because we now know this is still a computer character. This is not a virtual representation of a human. And so I think we don't reject it as easily. I think we become desensitized to the confusion that would cause an uncanny valley response, where you think a generated character is a human but not.
Well, and I think you hit the nail on the head where you said that we still can determine that it's a game and not real. But I think that's a conscious decision by the developers. If you look back at any of the BioWare games, from Mass Effect, Jade Empire, to Knights of the Old Republic, to the Old Republic, Dragon Age, the characters' proportion are cartoony. It's not, none of the characters are rendered in what would be considered a realistic human way. They're either idealized versions of beauty, they're either, you know, over muscularized men, there are aliens, there are samurais whose soul have taken over armor. Spoiler. There are things like that. And I think BioWare has gotten really good at looking at how can I make this look more realistic in the sense of conveying emotion, but still keep sort of a cartoony feel to it so that it doesn't make it off-putting. Whereas you sort of look at Valve and they try to base their characters off of real live humans, and I think it slips more into the valley. But I think game developers are shying away from going in that direction.
And they may be. I think there are a lot of conscious artistic choices that go into how do we want to present this? How do we integrate this into the greater experience of the overall game? Because ultimately, again, the graphics are not a less important part than the other components. In fact, they may in many ways be the most important part, but they're still subservient to the overall vision of what the game is. and what kinds of story or what kind of experience needs to be projected by that game. You expect differences in how things are done in Skyrim compared to Call of Duty. They're even both first-person-ish, but you kind of need things to work out. You need much more specific environmental detail when a big part of the game is picking up flowers so that you can turn them into a fine paste and drink them. You know, things like that. And so even when the graphics style is going to be very similar, there are different details and different things like that. And of course, the character model itself is going to be a part of the decision on what experience are we trying to convey. In Dead Space, I think that they made some characters, I think they intentionally tried to push them towards the Uncanny Valley because they wanted things to be creepy. And so you don't notice it as much because everything is creepy, and why not? So that's it's all about kind of the choice, and graphics are a very, very conscious choice of the developers. So I have to ask, you know, has there been a game that you found yourself playing purely because of the graphics, because of the art?
I think that there have definitely been games that I continued to play through for the art. In a minute, I'm going to think of one. It's hard to separate out, for me, the art from the storyline. I think the best example I can come up is Jade Empire. And I wasn't particularly enamored one way with the Jade Empire storyline. It seemed very simple on the surface. I didn't feel any sort of connection to the NPC characters. And basically, it has the worst gameplay mechanic at the very end that you can pretty much undo all of your decisions with, like, one decision, which sort of interferes with the lighter good. But the beauty of the world and the way that they rendered the world compelled me to continue to explore it. So, in a way, I think that's sort of tied into just purely the art. If it had been set in any other setting, I probably wouldn't have explored it. Or if the characters weren't as vividly created, or the world wasn't as fleshed out, or and when you went to the Imperial City, they had Imperial dogs that were sort of roaming the city, and it gave it a, sort of an authenticity that I enjoyed. But I'm not sure I could recommend Jade Empire for the story, or for the quests, or for the combat system, all of which I thought were very pedestrian. What about you, Steven?
Well, my example would be actually a game that I quite enjoy, but fairly recent, Far Cry 3. I really only wander around the island just to... I could push shrubs out of the way all day. I mean, just the way that this this tropical island was sort of imagined, you know, the initial town you sort of start in is kind of a shanty town, and it's there's a lot of detail in just the buildings and you know, kind of the feel of the entire environment. I thought was really well done, and that's not to say the game was bad, but would it drive me to just wander around the island? Probably not. But the encounters with the wildlife and things like that, it was just all very very interesting, and it really added something. And it's an example of how sound and the visuals contribute to the game, because a big part of, you know, if you're stalking animals so that you can cut down your third tiger because you know how to sew a wallet entirely out of tiger pelts, for whatever reason that works, however you're doing it, you know, there's a lot of things that you would at least expect, if not exactly realistically done, in actual hunting, where you're looking for something to move, or you're listening for, you know, a branch snapping and things like that. They did a good job with sort of portraying awareness through the visual, as well as through sound and vocalization, and knowing a kind of a coherent story. And I thought that was very well done.
And we both picked 3D examples, which I think is kind of funny. But I'm going to toss out two 2D games and get Steven's thoughts about the graphics on those. And the first is going to be Phoenix Wright. And then the second's going to be, even though they're by different developers, is Professor Layton. And for me, I think those are two examples where I couldn't imagine either of those games in a true 3D setting.
No, I don't think I certainly don't think they'd work as well, because they're a specific, I'll use Phoenix right here. It's kind of a puzzle game. And for the puzzle to work, 3D puzzlers oftentimes involve, they feel compelled to use movement. Think Portal. Portal is an excellent puzzle game, but it's about movement and kinetics. The Phoenix Wright games are about logic and a certain amount of spot the, one of these things is not like the other, spot the difference. And while those are very visual issues, because a lot of times you're looking at the portrayals of people, acts, and you're needing to see them, it's not really, it has nothing to do with movement. And so I think it goes back to what kind of experience do you want to portray. If you're in 3D, you're going to have to deal with movement. You have to explain movement. And so that's got to be incorporated in. People are going to expect it. That's the experience. If you want to do a story, there's actually another, one of the Trauma Center games actually includes a Phoenix Wright style where you're the medical examiner and you're looking for different components. It was great fun. If that's the experience you're going for, I could argue that not only would you not need 3D graphics, but in fact, even though they exist and they're easy to do, you should not use 3D graphics because they will undermine the experience. You will be forced to encounter elements that you are not actually trying to deal with in your game.
And let me ask you this. Is there a particular Phoenix Wright case that stuck out because of the visual aspect of it?
I was actually thinking of one during my last rant. There's one, I can't remember the case name off the top of my head, but there's one where it's about a broken urn. And a big part of it is looking at the urn and examining the urn and trying to figure out what happened. The other example I'll give that haunts me is from the aforementioned Trauma Center game. It was the Wii, one of the Wii Trauma Center games. And there, at one point, you're wandering around the room, clicking on things to try to examine clues, and you close a door, and you see bloody nail markings all over the back of the door. And that's when, you know, spoiler-ish for people who are... That's when you first realize that this was not someone who simply died of some problem. They were desperately trying to get out of this room, and it's one of those moments where the visual, just seeing it before the character has even commented on it, everything changes, because this has gone from probably a, you know, someone just dying of natural causes to possibly a murder. And that kind of thing can be very powerful, even though it's effectively just two still shots. It's just two paintings. The first painting shows the door open. The second painting shows the door closed. That's all that happened. That's the sum total of the graphics. We could have done this in 17th century England by painting two different, or in prehistoric times, by painting two slightly different buffalo with spears. But it communicated what it needed to communicate to get the story across. So I know you're an avid Professor Layton fan. Do you have any Professor Layton scenarios that you thought the visuals really told the story of the puzzle?
I think almost Professor Layton, you couldn't separate out from the visuals. I think in a way that, I mean, otherwise, setting aside the fact that it would just be logic puzzle after logic puzzle after logic puzzle, it's sort of this idea of, and this is why Professor Layton and the graphics really stick with me, is one of the central tenets of the game is sort of purity. And it's expressed through Professor Layton as being an English gentleman, and one of the values of that is purity, not in the sense, but being purity in the sense of purity of soul, not being tainted by darkness, not being tainted by evil. And you get a sense as you sort of explore more and more of the games that there has been darkness that touched his life, that he has lost a love, that he has, you know, lost a friend at one point, that he has suffered all of this loss, but he's still pushing on with the sort of Victorian ideology of what it means to be a gentleman. And then conversely, you have the other character, Luke, who's the professor's apprentice, who's a young boy struggling his way into sort of manhood, adulthood, establishing his own identity, and where does his childlike innocence kind of come into play with that. Then you have Fiona, which is a woman who has a very tragic story. When you sit down and look at the curious visit at the village and just sit down and think about what events actually occurred to justify this action, it's very disturbing. I mean, it's very haunting. It's very much a story about human connections, but the way the art style presents it is you get that sense of hope conveyed in the graphics, that are conveyed within the puzzles, that are conveyed in the exploration from how it's drawn, how it's detailed, that I think help sell the premise of the games of what otherwise could be very dark stories. I mean, almost all the Professor Layton games, when you sit down and really think about the story, are very dark. I mean, they deal with loss of parents, loss of love, loss of identity, loss of friendship, and exploring those themes. But the graphics imply a sense that even though despair is permeating the world, that there's still a sense of hope. And it's that sense of hope that you sort of cling to. And that's one of the things that has always resonated with me about the Professor Layton games, and allows me to ignore a lot of the facts that the logic puzzles tend to be largely the same after a while. But it's that sense of hope and exploration that you have these characters who seem real to you in the sense that they have desires. That is one of the things that I like about it.
And again, the exploration is driven by the art style. This kind of exploration is different than the exploration you would experience in Skyrim, hunting down dragons. But the experience is meant to have sort of that, is meant to be different. And so, again, I think it's not that the story necessarily drives graphics. It's that the experience drives both the story and the graphics. And so, much like movies, if you view video games as sort of a holistic unit, this is why they have a producer, because there, or depending on the individual project, it may vary, the title may vary, but this is why there's typically someone with a vision, and then they're attempting to, you know, bind these elements together to create a vision, which is why I think it is a ridiculous statement to suggest that video games are not art.
Well, let me ask you this, Stephen. Let's take a game series that I know is fond for both of us that has two distinct art styles. Let's start with Fallout 2. And let's start with Fallout 3. And which of those two did you enjoy more and why?
Okay, well, it's a weird example because Fallout 2, because Fallout 3 is maybe my least favorite Fallout.
We can do New Vegas.
I'm a huge New Vegas fan, which I realize puts me in the minority, but it's Vegas, baby. I mean, come on. You know, the interesting thing is, and I'm going to self-servingly use it to reinforce my own point, I think they were trying to go for two very different experiences. Fallout 2 is one of my favorite RPGs of all time. Fallout 1, I may like even more, but Fallout 2 was fantastic in its own right. Wonderful RPG. Loved the systems, loved the combat, loved basically everything about it. It was a great RPG, and it was telling a very RPG... Well, it was an unusual story, but if you break it down and kind of ignore the mature themes, it was still a very RPG story. It's this story about leaving your village and finding your place in the world, and then it's about revenge and hope and all of those kinds of things. The more recent Fallout games are still RPG-ish, and they're still telling a story, but there's a much greater focus on the experience they're trying to portray is survival. Not just the story and the goals of the story, but also, you know, there's a much greater focus on the individual enemies and, you know, the gunplay and kind of those interactions. And so it's less about strategy and more about, I'm going to stick with survival. You know, they're first person games. Obviously you can pause them and you have the VAT system and all that good stuff. But really, I don't feel like the new games in the Fallout series are as good in the RPG sense as 1 and 2 were. But I think they're excellent games in the, what I refer to all of those, the Skyrim, basically anything Bethesda does, as exploration games. Because ultimately what they're really about is environmental interaction. They're kind of very high quality versions of Minecraft with a lot more enemies. On some level, it's about getting out there and seeing things, and you can do the story or you cannot. That wasn't really an option in Fallout 1 and 2. I mean, you could wander around, but ultimately, because of the limitations on the map, you typically had to wander from fixed location to fixed location. And so they had exploration, but I don't feel like that was as much of the focus. What would be your answer? Same question. Fallout 2 compared to either 3 or New Vegas, your pick.
I'm happy to compare them to both. Fallout 3 is also my least favorite, but it has the virtue of having to pick one to be the least favorite.
Right.
Here is my fundamental problem with Fallout 3 and Fallout New Vegas versus Fallout 1 and Fallout 2 is the sprite-based graphics, the cartoony look, really sold me the universe. it really sold me the idea of skinning geckos for skin and sort of this wooden shack where you could just picture there being moonshine and there's these random trees dotted across, or going back to Fallout 1, Junktown, or going back to Fallout 2, looking at the New California Republic, looking at Vault City. I mean, the cartoony graphics really could sell me on those places that could exist. Like, in a way, I can feel that the world was almost more real because the humor came across in the graphics. So some of the absurdity of the universe of being, what if 1950s future actually happened in a post-apocalyptic wasteland? Clearly, nothing that happened in Fallout 1 or Fallout 2 could be our future because technology's...
That ship has sailed.
Yeah, I mean, the technology's changed, but that was part of the joke, was what if these vault drawings had become our future? What if this was true? But when you look at Fallout 3 and Fallout New Vegas, and you have to see the dankness of the world, you have to see the browns, you have to see buildings that are more realistic because you're moving through them, in a way forced me to lose some of the credibility of the story, which is completely bizarre to say, because obviously it's not a credible story to begin with. But the authenticity of the world was lost to me a little bit in Fallout 3 and New Vegas. And I think one of the examples I would use in New Vegas is the Tenpenny Hotel. I could see in Fallout 1 or 2 how that quest would exist and how you could kind of go back and forth between the characters, and there'd be some brightly drawn ghouls, and you know, there'd be some humorous text that went along, and you'd have the citizens and their absurdity, and it would be have some humor to it in the dark, and with the same darkness, with the same notion of racism implied into it. But in New Vegas, I felt like some of that was lost because when you're in a 3D space, there's this drive to be more realistic. And so I think that's kind of a question I've always struggled with the new Fallout games, which I love, is that do they really feel like Fallout games? And if they don't, why is that? And I think some of it is the charm of the original graphics.
I think that's true. And I basically treat them as successors to the universe, but not they're not really, to me, RPGs anymore. There are stat lines. They're this Western hybrid RPG that's sort of grown up, which is fun. I quite enjoy it. Like I said, I love New Vegas, particularly the DLC that involved the think tank. Is one of my favorite Fallout experiences, but they're not really the same. And really, the biggest difference, because the stories are much the same. This is a good example for that. The story is basically the same. This is a post-apocalyptic wasteland. It's a fairly dark universe, and there's always this wry humor that permeates just almost everything. The story didn't change, but the game is completely different because the art, the graphical art behind it did change.
And I think you hit the nail on the head, and that's what was missing to me in Fallout 3 and New Vegas, is the wry humor didn't permeate everything. When you looked at a burned-out building in Fallout 3 and Fallout New Vegas, it just looked like a burned-out building.
See children chasing around a giant rat. It kind of strikes as more... it's harder to maintain the humor when you're having to deal with the reality of the situation.
And I think part of what sold it, and Steven talked about, is when you have the smaller graphics that you have to have the larger expression. So in the original Fallouts, when the kids would wave their hands over their head and run screaming away from a whole bunch of humor scenarios, it became less real that you were looking at children. It was just like you're looking at small sprites.
It was over the top. It was the over-the-top nature kind of spares you from some of the... from the harsh reality of the situation.
And that's, to me, what was missing. And not saying that they weren't good games in their own right, not saying that I didn't enjoy them, but I think that the graphics became the missing disconnect. It seems that you are implying that graphics and gameplay go hand in hand.
I think that since the graphics... We refer to the graphics engine, and so I feel that it's a little bit difficult to distinguish the two, because... ultimately, it's all part of the experience, but especially with graphics. Graphics are, in a video game, as the word video implies, the visual, in some ways, is the gameplay. How you interact with the universe via the controls, that's all going to be monitored through the rubric of, you know, how you're seeing the interaction. And you can use sound, and you can use story, and that works quite well, but still, the interaction itself is most quickly communicated through the eyes. And so even though for me, in a lot of ways, story is the most important component, it's kind of impossible to have the gameplay, a video game, I think, without at least acknowledging whatever graphical component is there, whether it be text-based ASCII drawings and text, or, 9,000 or 50,000, however many polygons Chris Roberts is using for his spaceships that we have in Star Citizen. You have to address that, and I don't think you can really discuss gameplay without discussing how you're doing that.
Well, let me ask you this question. Do you see a difference between the 2D and the 3D Mario games?
The 2D ones were better, but aside from that, yes, because I hate to give a truism as an example, but there's another dimension that you're having to interact with. Like I said, in puzzle games, one reason not to use 3D graphics is movement becomes the puzzle. In 2D versus 3D games, I think a similar thing happens. The you're dealing with different kinds of platforming. You're dealing with different kinds of interaction. And so the gameplay is driven by that extra dimension, by the different ways you can fall off of things, as my custom in jump in platforming puzzle games.
So let me ask you this. Why do you think the 3D Mario games were worse?
Well, a lot of design decisions. When we were talking about before the show, is the decision to... this one was only barely 3D. This is a hybrid of 2D and 3D. But in the Wii version of Super Mario Brothers, the ability to kill the people you're playing with over and over and over again for no reason. But also, when I'm platforming, there's something about the exploration in a 2D world that causes you to have to, I think, be on your toes to find those secret areas, to think, gee, I could bust through this ceiling. Or the limitation of how little there is lulls you into a false sense of security, and so you really need to be thinking about how to explore that two-dimensional space. It's almost too easy in three dimensions to hide things. It's almost too easy to just put it off on the side where no one would look. Your platforming is a lot more about the jumping puzzle than about the puzzle of how do I get through this passage without hitting any of the enemies. Something about the 3D Mario games is just missing for me. Maybe it's nostalgia. That's the simplest explanation. But I just didn't enjoy them. The only Mario game that I thought been a complete home run. The most recent one for me would have been Super Mario RPG, which was a long time ago. But had a blast with that. The Paper Mario games are good. But other than that, I prefer the 2D platforming.
Well, I would posit that you should play New Super Mario Brothers on the DS. Nice. I think that one is a home run.
Okay, fair enough.
But let me ask you this question, and speaking of graphics, do you feel that, setting aside the story issues and the gameplay mechanics, that the second Deus Ex game was hurt by its graphics?
See, I don't. I think the game may have had problems, but I don't think the graphics hurt it as bad, and I understand the argument they may have. I liked the new Deus Ex game, and I thought that kind of they did a good job of rendering this futuristic world, or at least as good a job as could be expected, and that in many ways some deficiencies in gameplay were sort of saved by the, you know, I kind of, this to me felt like a more believable future than some futuristic games, and that, you know, you kind of saw familiar buildings, but with, you know, high-tech security keypads, and you saw weapons that looked very much like our weapons, but sort of how I can imagine the modern firearm evolving over the next, over the coming decades. And so I didn't really feel like the graphics got in the way of the presentation they were trying to make.
And how do you feel about the third Batman Arkham Asylum game coming out, both as a 3D game and then as a 2D handheld version? Do you think that there will be something lost in the translation?
Yes, and hopefully how they'll do it is they'll try to go for two different experiences, because I hope that they can't get the same experience out of both, because it means one of them is very deficient, because you can play with the medium in different ways. On a handheld game especially, being handheld in and of itself introduces new ways to sort of play with the medium, in that you can do things like you can interact with saving differently. you can interact with exploration differently because more is generally not going to be visible because you're not looking forward out into the world. You're looking down onto the world, onto a slice of the world. And so you can do a lot more with the unseen just off screen. Whereas in 3D, obviously, you can do a lot more with movement and with, you know, bizarre Batman-like flips and maneuvers in multiple directions. There's just different things you can do with both. Are you looking forward to those games?
I'm looking forward to both of them.
But for different reasons or for the same reason?
For different reasons. Let me start off with my disclaimer. I'm very hesitant about what's going to happen without Rocksteady. But setting aside, that's more of a technical issue. I'm looking forward to the next 3D game because for some reason the combat system in Batman Arkham Asylum is just addicting to me. I will occasionally play Arkham City just to beat up on some bad guys.
I did find their portrayal of on a comic. Well, we can I can relate this to art style. I thought their portrayal of the universe was one of the better ones of the Batman universe, especially some of the ways in both games the Joker is shown, is visually represented. I thought was pretty true to kind of. And everyone's different. It's a subjective standard, but how I think of the Joker as sort of this angular madman. And they did, I thought, a pretty good job of using the visuals of the Joker when he would talk to you through TVs and things like that to tell you non-verbally about the Joker. You know, he's the kind of guy who would stick a TV on a mannequin so that it looked like a mannequin with a TV for a head, but then he would put his head on it. That kind of tells you about how he approaches things. You know, he wants everyone to know that this is bizarre, this is twisted, it's like reality, but it's not. And that's kind of the Joker's whole thing. And they did a good job of portraying that entirely through the art style. I don't think you had to know the comic books to understand the Joker in the Arkham games. I don't think you necessarily had to have the sound on to understand the Joker. You could just look at how they present the Joker to understand the Joker.
And I feel like taking another character is the way they did Killer Croc. That you really, they conveyed something that has always been missing in the Killer Croc portrayals as why this guy seems supremely dangerous. That he's not necessarily the smartest villain, he's not necessarily the most clever villain, he's not necessarily the strongest villain, but there's just something,
so much of him.
There's just something primitive there that resonates in a make you uneasy. And I thought the Arkham Asylum game's true genius was is they blended the animated series Batman visuals with the TV, with the movie and the comic book visuals to create a unique style which was familiar for both.
Right, and I did. Arkham City was an excellent game, but I really liked the art in Arkham Asylum. It was this enclosed space, and they really did a lot to portray the asylum and the different villains. Especially, like I said, I'm a huge fan of the Joker just in general, but I really thought they did an excellent job with his visuals. They did something interesting in that you kind of take combat damage and your armor gets progressively more beat up as the game's story progresses. And that's another example of how you can kind of drive the story itself through various different graphic art style.
And speaking of Arkham Asylum, is it really showed like this is one of the worst days Batman's ever had.
Right.
And you see that visually as the, you know, his combat armor, that's a good way to put it, his suit gets torn, his cape gets torn, you know, gets tired. You almost get the feeling that he moves slower later in the game. Even though it's not true.
And it's also a game that does a good job of showing how graphics interact with our visceral reaction, our emotional reaction. You could say, oh, this person got blown up. Or you could show everyone that person, you know, some of the Arkham games are not happy games. You know, when characters die, a lot of times you see it happen. And that can really, you know, those games much more so, I think, even than the animated series was aimed at a younger audience, so they scaled it back a lot. But the Arkham games are not aimed at a younger audience, and they really show you, I think, kind of the reality of the Batman universe, which is that while he tries not to kill anyone, his opponents have no such compulsion, and these are crazy, dangerous people. It really does an excellent job of not hiding that from anyone in its art style, and that increases the emotional impact. It really increases, you know, why the protagonist feels like he has to stop this, and I really thought it had an excellent emotional draw.
And let me end this part on this question. Has there ever been a game you stopped playing because of the art style?
That is a good one. I can't... The only examples I can come up with are things that I couldn't play through a second time, where nostalgia wasn't enough to get me through the game again. My example of that is not a popular one, and I hesitate to even say it. I have not completed Final Fantasy VII again recently because the Star Fox quality polygons aren't doing it for me. Now, I'm making another run at it, but I just have been spoiled, and I have trouble with... The combat scenes are fine. It's when I'm not in combat. If I was in combat pretty much constantly, I think I'd be okay. But that is an example of where the graphics are getting in my way. I need them to redo... They're doing an HD version of Final Fantasy X. I need them to go back and redo Final Fantasy VII. But that would be one. I can't think of any others where the graphics were just completely unacceptable. But that's because I think generally I try to get good games. In a good game, the graphics are at least going to match the intent. Do you have one where it just stopped you in your tracks?
Actually, you mentioned it. It's Star Fox. I love Star Fox. I love the story about Star Fox. But every time I play a Star Fox game, I'm like, I don't like the visuals.
And I will say that art ages in different... One of the World of Warcraft's biggest triumphs is that they picked an art style that just won't age. Whereas I really think those 3D polygons... There was a brief era. There aren't many games that used the blocky just polygons. Final Fantasy VII, Star Fox. There are a few. I really feel like that art style didn't age well at all.
No, and it becomes, because it's a transition phase, it's a phase that was necessary, but you just see it as a, like, and it's true of real art. Like, there's always like a transition phase of art where people are like, yeah, I don't like that, but we need to explore it because it showed how I got from A to B, how we went from sort of realism to impressionism, that there's sort of like a blurry line in between there, and it's like, no. And then I think games sort of have the same thing. It's just part of the history.
And so while I can go back, I've played through Xenogears several times, sprite-based graphics, also a PlayStation game. It works fine. Doesn't bother me. For some reason, the Final Fantasy VI I've played through recently, totally sprite-based, two-dimensional. Final Fantasy VII, those polygons, for some reason, I just can't go back and deal with the... Back when we could count polygons on both hands.
Well, and I think that sort of covers our first main segment, where we kind of discuss a broad idea in our series on gaming as art. My quick thought for the podcast is time-based sales on digital products. I understand why we do it. I understand why it has to exist. I understand that when you don't have Walmart pushing merchandise and convincing me that if I don't walk out of the store with it, I will never have it. It just annoys me to no end when it's digital. Not going to name any names, Star Citizen. But it always seems weird to me that you have time release sales on digital content that I can't immediately have. So there's some sort of intellectual disconnect for me handing you real dollars now and you handing me back the promise of polygons at some point in the future. But if I don't do it now, then I won't have those polygons in the future. That just, I understand why it happens, but just seems disconcerting to me in a way. And the same thing is true with forcing me to pre-order things and having... Like, Steam's now kind of become bad about that. And not necessarily Valve, but publishers on Steam who say, you have to pre-order this game now in order to get XYZ bonus. But how am I to know your game's not a buggy mess until I've actually had to play it? And you know that I could do that. And I know why you're doing that, publishers. I'm just saying.
I have to interject, though. I mean, because I know a little bit about your Star Citizen history. It worked, didn't it?
Well, and that's what upsets me more. The fact is not that it's ineffective, is that it works all too well.
Just to let everyone in on the joke, at the end, at the conclusion of that brief sale, our illustrious co-host actually did purchase a ship. So, you know, they do it because it works. And my only follow-up on that would be, you know, the biggest solution to most things in the world is also the most difficult, which is if we wouldn't put up with it, they'd stop doing it.
Right, but we're all weak and want to have our digital fun.
Exactly. So that is the problem. And that kind of leads me into my segment. This will, I've no doubt, be a much larger thing, but I wanted to comment earlier in our show's inception sort of just on, while the proverbial iron was hot, on hardware-based DRM. We could talk for days and days and days about DRM, but in the wake of both the inclusion and then rapid removal, perhaps even defenestration, I just wanted to use that word, of the hardware-based DRM in the Xbox One, a lot of people have said this is inevitable. This is the wave of the future. We're going to start having DRM that is based not just the software DRM, but hardware-based DRM, where things simply won't work on a machine if you don't jump through X, Y, and Z hoops. Well, for extent, calling it inevitable is a little bit misleading because it already existed back when we had to have discs for games. What was that if not hardware-based DRM on some level? The difference was back then, once you owned the game, you could give it to someone else, and the DRM was basically limited to you buy one copy and only one person can be using that copy at a time. Whereas now what's happened is publishers want to make sure that they want to do away with the first sale doctrine. It's not important what that is for those who don't, the specific legality, but basically they don't want you to be able to give your game to somebody else. They want you to buy a license and you can play it, but no one else ever can. They want that person to buy their own license. This, of course, caused outrage. Microsoft was going to do something similar to this. They pulled the system back because of the dramatic public outcry. Huge boon for Sony. Sony didn't even have to advertise the PS4. They just had to advertise that they weren't Microsoft. And as a result, Microsoft's backed out on almost all of what they said. The worry is that this will keep being an argument with every future console. I'm not sure that it will, or at least that this particular argument will continue, because ultimately I think what will happen is we will go to a Steam-based, completely online digital distribution system to begin with, not soon, but eventually, and the issue will be mooted because it won't be a hardware DRM system, because the hardware will be secondary to the distributor, which is going to be something very much like Steam. Point to all this, it is important to continue to protest the bizarre draconian DRM systems. We have seen two examples where we got results, both the Microsoft thing, and we being all gamers everywhere, and also Ubisoft backing down on their idiotic DRM system. The thing to remember is that you need reasonable goals. We are probably not going to stop people from moving to a Steam-based or a cloud-based distribution system. We see it through the PlayStation Store, we see it through the Microsoft Store, we see it through Steam. That's probably going to happen, much to the irritation of GameStop. I feel sorry for them, but this seems to be where it's going. What we can do is continue to reinforce that we want to own the digital rights to our games. The first sale doctrine does not have to go away simply because there isn't a physical copy. And so it is important to try to encourage publishers who have DRM-free games, independent developers, who will allow you to then give your game to someone else. A little bit on the honor system, but there are ways to make it where there is one license. Steam is the perfect platform for that. There is no reason it shouldn't be possible to trade my license for a game on Steam to someone else. I can already do it as long as I've never installed the game once. And so I think the goal then of those of us who oppose draconian DRM schemes is not to yell into that, not go screaming into that night, because it's probably coming, where we just don't need physical media anymore. It is to encourage the correct use of digital media to manage, to make sure that we maintain the rights as consumers, rather than allowing the publishers to basically just generously allow you to play their game so long as they... And the quintessential example of why that's so important is what happens when inevitably EA decides that they don't want to maintain the SimCity servers anymore. You no longer have a game.
And that's why SimCity is a disaster and should be pointed to with much derision and publicly shamed for the complete idiocy of that entire project. But I have a slightly different thought than Steven does on that, in the sense that I don't think Microsoft actually backed down because of the outcry. I think that it's fun to go blame corporations for being dumb, but almost all corporations are run by really smart people. And Microsoft didn't, like, one day wake up and say, we should put in all this DRM because what's the worst that's going to happen? I mean, they studied it. They had focus groups. And here's the dirty little secret that I don't think anybody's talking about, but they should be talking about it, is they went and talked to publishers. And they said, hey, publishers, would you be cool if we did this? And the publishers all said, oh, hell yeah. This is what they want. This is how they see it. Where this completely went awry is when Microsoft said their DRM spiel and said, look how awesome this is. And then they pointed at the publishers to back them up and said, we're going to make the magic happen. And the publishers were like, we weren't realizing how bad the backlash was. And then there was crickets coming from all of the publishers. And that's what stopped it. That Microsoft was afraid that publishers would then, in light of the public backlash, not have the fortitude to continue to release games just on the Xbox, that they would lose to PlayStation because the publishers would feel they had no choice. So I don't necessarily think that the DRM is going to be stopped for that reason, because literally everybody but us wants that to happen, and maybe even GameStop, but I think GameStop's smart enough to figure out that they can get on a Steam bandwagon at some point and get their cut of the pie.
No, they've already attempted. They have their own digital distribution app. It's just suffers from not being Steam.
Right, and that, I mean, at some point, that's a business decision. And at some point, that, as Steven said, Steam's going to be the future. But here is the bottom line of why I think this will happen, is that Steam is a hardware-based DRM. I mean, it doesn't lock you technically to one computer, but you have to have a computer. It is hardware. It is, the system is so, the DRM of Steam I love because I accept that I have to have DRM, but make no mistake, it's insidious. There are limitations that are hard limitations built into it. And here is why I think it's inevitable, is the attack on the first sell doctrine is not unique to video game manufacturers. They're just the latest to bring it. The person who's actually been fighting this battle since, I don't know, the first printing press was made is book publishers. And they finally won. And digital ebooks on the Kindle system has won. And make no mistake, the lawsuit between publishers and Apple and Amazon has nothing to do with whether or not ebooks are a good idea. It has to do with who is going to hold the loss of the changeover and what the price of, how can we artificially raise the price of ebooks to be at the level we want to pay off the current system. But ebooks have won the battle, and that is all hardware-based DRM.
Oh, I agree with much of that. I think that ultimately, whether it was Microsoft backing down because of the publishers or Microsoft backing down in its own right, it was the pressure, I think, on some level, the public outcry that caused it one way or the other. So I think I encourage people to attempt as best we can as gamers. We typically are weak-willed. I own SimCity, for example. To do the best we can to make it clear that that this is not something that we want to happen. Now, part of me says that it will simply, like I said, it is not only inevitable, but that the first sale doctrine will simply be killed barring legislation to the contrary, which will never occur. That I do feel pretty confident about. But it's still important, if for no other reason than to preserve the objection, I think it's still important to kind of register the issues with DRM and how sort of dangerous it can be to the concept of ownership, because what we're going to see in video games that we don't see in books is typically, even if they start supporting my Nook, it would still work until the device itself died.
Which will happen.
Which will happen. But the book also is in, so far, or generally in formats that I can put on another device, much like Steam, where I can go to another computer. The difference between that and what happened with SimCity is I have no control over the game simply ceasing to exist. I truly only own, much like an MMO, I only have a license into someone else's game. I do not have a game. And that actually is, I think, the battle line I've drawn is I want to avoid that. I accept it for MMOs because there are technical reasons that it has to exist that way for MMOs, more or less. But the for other games, as was pointed out about a billion times on the forum, SimCity had no reason to work like that. It has never worked like that in the past, and their multiplayer features, quite frankly, are pathetic. So there was no reason to do it that way. They just did it anyway.
Well, the reason why they did it was so they could push out DLC and make money.
All right. And so that, you know, when they come out with their follow-up version, they will wait a year and then they will shut down these servers and force everyone to get the new one. This is a move towards planned obsolescence, and I oppose, because generally, no matter how idiotic Ubisoft's DRM scheme was, unless their authentication server goes down, they don't control it on a game-by-game basis, as long as, and they turned this off, but even under their old scheme, as long as their authentication server stayed up, I could still play any of my games on any computer, as long as I didn't install it more than a few times, which is one of the Steam limitations. But those are limitations and DRM that exist to keep proliferation of copies of the game, right or wrong, that's the effect. What's happening with SimCity, I think, is less about controlling piracy and more about creating a system where they can make more money off of the same property. I'm willing to allow, because I'm old, a certain amount of DRM to prevent piracy. I understand how piracy can be a problem. But when EA goes and does something that's not really having anything to do with piracy, it has to do with, we want to be able to control the property completely against our legitimate users. That, to me, is a bigger issue.
And I kind of agree with that. I think that we accept DRM, Steven and I, not to stop piracy, even though that's what we'll say, but we'll support it in the sense as long as it doesn't inconvenience us, because that, at the end of the day, is the selfish concern, and which is why nobody ever talks about the Steam DRM anymore, or what happens if Valve servers collapse.
Which, on some level, is pretty draconian DRM. I will allow that.
And I see the solution is ultimately screaming at Microsoft and the publishers is going to be only so effective, but the accountants are immune because they don't care. Because at some point, the money will make sense to basically upset people. That's how accounting works. You can actually allocate lost sales. It's a dirty little secret. But the solution to me is to support platforms like GOG.com, to support the Witcher series, which gives you the game DRM free. And lastly, to continue to support Kickstarter projects that seem viable, because that's a path to allow games to be made and sold free of DRM.
Or at least outside the publisher system, which is in its own right a... not that the publisher system doesn't have its place, but in general, and we talked about this, I think, a little bit with the Kickstarter, it's always good to have an alternative, and we don't want to end up with a lack of competition.
And I think that'll do it for this episode of Gamers Footnotes, our semi-pretentious thoughts on gaming. Join us next time for our third installment of Games as Art series, where we will discuss more semi-pretentious things and learn to justify games as art. Thank you and good night.